There's three sides to every story. There's my side, your side, and the truth.
Kaya, and welcome to The Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew Pierce, and this podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. On this episode, I chat with Aussie filmmaker Jack Dignan about his found footage horror film, Puzzle Box. Olivia, played by Lenneke Denny, heads out to the remote house in the woods to help her sister Kate, played by Caitlin Boyer, rehabilitate and escape her life of addiction. Olivia aims to document the process, almost in a way to show how far Kate will heal and change over time. Little does she know, instead of documenting Kate's rehabilitation, she instead manages to document the labyrinth-like house that they become trapped in, where time loops over itself and unsettling events occur in the night. Puzzle Box would have its Australian premiere at the upcoming A Night of Horror International Film Festival in Sydney on September 29th. This is the second time that Jack has had a film screen at the festival, with his previous film, After She Died, winning the Best Australian Feature Film and Best Australian Feature Performance in 2022. In the following interview, Jack talks about where his interest in found footage films comes from, and how working on films like Marvel's Shang-Chi and George Miller's Furiosa differs from working on an independent feature film, as well as how his previous work as a film critic informs his work as a director. To find out more about Jack's work, head over to jackdignan.com. And to find out more about interviews and reviews that I've done, head over to thecurb.com.au. And to pick up tickets for A Night of Horror International Film Festival, make sure to visit the link in the show notes. For now, here is a trailer to Puzzle Box.
Tell me you heard a scream.
I heard something.
I guess what I want to start talking about is jumping back to your beginning as deciding to become a filmmaker. What was the fertile ground that idea got set into, that this is what I want to do going forward?
Yeah, I mean, well, big question. I guess it goes way back, you know. I mean, when I was a little tiny Jack, you know, very small and young, I mean, I was very into animation, and I was very into, you know, like the Pixar films when I was a kid, like Toy Story and things like that. And then it's documentaries. And for a while, I thought I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. And when I say that, I mean, when I was like 5 years old. And then from there, it kind of just like naturally transitioned into movies. And I don't know if there was ever a moment where I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. It was just kind of like always the path I was heading down. And yeah, just over the years, just made it a reality.
And was there a particular film that you looked at and said, you know, this is the kind of story that I want to tell? Was there a horror film that you watched as a kid, or something that maybe had horror elements in it that you were like, yeah, that's hit the spot?
I think there's several key films across the years. I think it's always been a genre that I've quite gravitated towards. You know, when you're younger, it feels like sort of a forbidden genre that you're not quite allowed to watch. And then, you know, your parents let you watch one and it traumatizes you for life. I think the first one I ever watched, it's not even really super scary, but you know, when you're very young, I watched The Sixth Sense and I couldn't sleep for like a week. And then I think that just sort of kick-started a love for it. It led me into being obsessed with like Tim Burton when I was a little kid. And from there, that was just opened up the gates for the whole genre. And I mean, I don't know, the older I get, the more I find myself drawn to it as well. You know, I think it's a really creative genre. I think there's a lot of unique things you can do in it that other genres don't quite allow you to do. And I don't know, it's just the genre I continually come back to over the years. You know, I'll always watch every new horror film every week.
There is something that is quite comforting about horror. As you're saying, like, it's such a varied genre, but there's something that you know that you're going to get something that might be a little bit unhinged, or it might set you on edge, but at least there is a safety with that, that you can go in and engage with that in a sense that, yeah, letting yourself go towards a horror film is one of the great treats. I know growing up, like for me, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I watched that far too young and I let myself go to that, and it just, It's unsettling, and it's interesting you mentioned The Sixth Sense. Like, that in itself is an unsettling film. When you think about it, it's a really depressing, sad film, but it's also got some genuinely horrifying moments in it.
The scene where the little kid gets, like, locked in that, what's the little place he gets locked into, and you hear the ghost in there, but you can't see anything. I was like, that is a terrifying sequence.
It's upsetting, and there is something that's enjoyable about being upset by something that you watch. But I'm curious for you as a creator of horror films, what's it like being somebody who is creating something that will upset people, that might cause them to feel disturbed?
Yeah, another good question. I mean, it's interesting. It's such a unique genre in that way, because I don't know if my goal is ever to upset people. You know, I don't want people to necessarily walk out of my movies and be like, God, I hate life and I hate watching films. And God, I'm so worst genre ever. I mean, you want to scare people. You want to give people a good scare. You want to hopefully make people, you know, double check what's hiding in the dark corners of their room when they get home at night, especially with this one. You know, we were very much wanting to make people feel scared of, you know, walking down a hallway, or, you know, seeing what's downstairs or upstairs. And we were trying to make the house a terrifying labyrinth that you can easily get lost in. But, you know, I don't know if that's the main takeaway I ever want from my movies. I think between my first film, After She Died, and, you know, without spoiling what happens in Puzzle Box, I think it begins very much within the realm of horror, and it begins with all these jump scares, and it begins with these terrifying concepts. And not that we ever drop that, you know, we keep it consistent throughout the whole movie. But as you know, by the time we get to the finale, it sort of, it becomes something more. And I always want audiences to take away something from the end of the movie. And I want them to realize that all of these scares and all of these jump scares and these horrific characters, they've all been building towards this climax that, I'm trying not to spoil it now, but, you know, it ties all of the elements together in a way that hopefully resonates in a quite a moving and interesting way, if that makes sense, without giving away my entire plot.
No, it does, because that leads into the next question, which is about ensuring that the horror or the scares that you're working with have an emotional underpinning. How important is that for you to have that as that kind of context for the script to work on, and, you know, for the actors to build on, to have that emotional bond between two siblings, in particular for Puzzle Box? Like, it's got to be like a really vital thing, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably the most vital thing. I think we were talking about during rehearsals and shooting it. We had a script, but it was very loose. We had all of the key beats and all of the scenes and breakdowns and whatnot. And then there was dialogue on the page, but it was very loose, and I wanted to give the actors the opportunity to do their own version of it and improvise scenes and come up with their own dynamic between the two characters. So we only had a short little rehearsal period. Deliberately, we talked about possibly doing a more extensive rehearsal period, but I wanted to keep it quite loose deliberately. So most of the rehearsals weren't even rehearsing the script. It was more so rehearsing these two characters and rehearsing their backstory and coming up with scenes that never even made the movie, and just finding the dynamic there. And then once we had that locked into it, once we'd had the characters, you know, pretty much well realized, we were able to bring that to set and bring that into the scares. And we had to make sure that all of the scares related back to all of these things that we discussed and planned about with the characters and with the actors. So all of the scares had to tie back into who Kate, our protagonist, is as a person. I found that I had to, during the editing process as well, we had a bunch of scares that were just kind of there to be scares. You know, there was just characters popping out and things running at the camera. And it was kind of like, okay, you know, they're scary scenes. You know, maybe they'll make the Blu-ray and they'll be a deleted scenes. But in terms of the actual narrative, they don't quite play into her emotional arc. They don't quite play into her character development and the journey she goes on to rehabilitate herself. And so, you know, I have to always ask myself, you know, does the scare work? And if it does, great, awesome. But then B, does it tie into who she is as a character? And if the answer to that is no, then the scare gets cut. You know, it doesn't make the film. It doesn't progress her arc forward in any way, shape, or form. So there's no need for a film for a scene like that to be in this movie.
That's all right. I completely understand that. Let's talk about the characters here. So we've got Caitlin Boyer, who is I know her from The Furies, which is this really, it's a polar opposite kind of horror film. It is bloody and bleak and all this kind of stuff.
She has a great death in that, gets her face cut clean off.
Yeah, it's probably the most memorable death in the film. It is unflinching. But I'm curious if you can talk about how you went about building the character with her and you know, what the casting process was like with her as well.
Yeah, well, I knew Caitlin before making this movie, so we were already friends, and so I wrote the film for her to be in it. So she was always the lead. She was always the reason I pretty much made the movie was to work with her, you know, her excuse for us to work together, hence the reason why that character's name is Kate, because I was like, if I put her name, she'll definitely have to say yes to it. Quickly, I pitched it to her in, like, November, December last year, and then I sent her a first draft before Christmas, and we were filming in March, so it was a real quick turnaround. We already had a strong dynamic, a strong bond, and we were both keen to work with each other. So it was just pretty much, hey, here's the film. Here's what I want to do. I want to develop it with you. I want to help. I want you to help me find this character more. I want you to elevate what's on the page. And she did. You know, we had a lot of conversations just between her and I about the character and about her backstory. And we went deep into things that only translate to a single line in film. You know, there's a lot of different elements that we put together. And, you know, each day on set, we were just talking through before we started shooting about, you know, the meaning behind certain scenes and certain lines of dialogue and how we can change those lines and how we can, you know, we were rewriting on the spot. You know, I had the script on my iPad. I had my little Apple pen. We were just crossing off lines and rewriting new lines and coming up with things on the spot just to develop her character. And I mean, it was the same with Lanika, who plays Olivia in the film, but Caitlin was the genesis of this movie. So it all kind of built around her as both an actor and a character.
And they become cinematographers too, in a way too.
They do. Yes. Yeah. They're both in charge of the character. But
can you talk about that creative choice as well? Obviously it is a core aspect of found footage, but you know, I know that some found footage films are shot by a cinematographer and others are shot by the actors. So can you talk about the discussion behind that and also what kind of training or, I guess, guidance did you give them as they were shooting the film?
You know, it was always meant to be a found footage movie. There was never any question about the format that we'd shoot it. I know there's a lot of horror movies that, you know, back in the heyday of found footage that didn't begin as found footage films and they changed it to save money. But ours was always meant to be a found footage movie. So that was always in the script, the way that the two characters sort of at one point one person's filming, at another point another person's filming, and they switched the camera around at different points in the movie. That was always going to be the plan. It was always the pitch to the actors. They're both pretty creative. They're both directors in their own right. They're both filmmakers in their own right, Lanika and Caitlin. So they know their way around the camera probably more so than I do. We had like one day camera rehearsal, like literally the day before we started shooting. I was like, here's the camera. Here's the style of shooting. Here's our test footage of all the transitions and how to get that right. And I had a lot of trust in them. I believed in them. And so each time before we'd start shooting, I would take the camera and I would show them the sort of general blocking I want. I'd show them the sort of the shot that we're after. And then I would pretty much hand it off to them and let them have their own go. And after each take, I'd sit down with them. We watch it. I'd give them notes on both the performance and both the camera shots. Yeah, from there, it was just a very creative, collaborative situation we found ourselves in. And there's a few shots that I'm also behind the camera on. I won't spoil which, but there's a few sneaky ones that I was just like, yeah, it's easier if I just do it. No one's in this shot anyway. It's fine. We'd ADR the dialogue afterwards. No, it was good. I mean, they nail it. And they brought their own extra dynamic to it as well. You know, I mean, I'd show them the shot, but they give it something I didn't even think of, which elevated the shot.
One of the things I noticed as well is that there was almost like this, you get a sense of the personality of the person by the way that they hold the camera and by the way that they, you know, frame shots as well. Obviously, you're showing them where things should be and what should be in frame, but it's also one is a little bit more jittery than the other, and you just get a sense of who they are or their emotional state of where they're sitting in that moment. Can you talk about possibly creating a character through cinematography, how that informs who they are as characters?
That we definitely were conscious of that as we were shooting it, and that is the reason why we established Kate first from the perspective of Olivia, so we have to see Olivia's point of view of the world, so we get sort of a subjective view of who she is as a person, and we slowly unravel the truth. And then when we make that shift and then Caitlin becomes the one who's in charge of the camera, the film takes on a different perspective entirely. You know, we so often in found footage, the person behind the camera, you don't even know what they look like throughout the whole movie. You know, you never really get a sense of who they are as a person. And because this film is only, it's only got two central characters, right? There's other people that appear throughout it, but it's the two central characters for a lot of the film. I wanted to make sure that we knew who those people were the entire time. I didn't want one of them to get lost behind the camera for the entire movie. You know, we'd never see their face. We never really get a sense of who they are. So it was very important for me to establish one and then switch and then, you know, go back and forth throughout the film. And they got very quite competitive about that as well, actually. When we were shooting it, they were all trying to compete to get the better shot. And they're always asking who was the better camera operator. And I'll never reveal my secrets. But they both brought a really unique visual perspective to it, which I quite liked.
It is, again, that it is a nice visual perspective and we get an idea of who they are as people. I'm curious if you can talk about if there are any found footage films that inspired you in the making of this. Was there something that you looked at as a template that you went, yeah, this is the kind of film that I want to use as a reference point?
Yeah, there's a bunch of reference points that we used. I sent a big list of, like, I think 5 or 6, maybe even 7 found footage movies to the actors to watch beforehand, and they watched none of them, but that's okay. We talked about films like Rec, the Spanish film from 2007, I want to say, which has a very similar visual style to ours, where it starts quite, you know, natural lighting, and they're walking through this house, and then it becomes a light rigged on top of a camera, and that's your only real source of light, and then it goes into night vision towards the end of Rec. So that was a big inspiration. Blair Witch Project obviously is the godfather of found footage movies. I mean, that's the all-time great one. Me and Caitlin actually watched that the night before shooting, because we were living in the house together, like me and the cast. So literally the night before shooting, we just kind of put it on just to get into that sort of found footage mindset, you know, just to live in that world for a little bit. And we took a lot of visual cues from that. And even recent films, I mean, like Skinamarink, I quite liked the visual. It's not quite found. It's sort of found footage. It's a very unique style, which I was quite a fan of. And I liked their use of grain and their use of darkness as well. So even looking at modern found footage films like that, we were able to take inspiration from.
I'm curious for you. Obviously, you used to do film criticism as well. And I'm interested in seeing how that has informed you as a filmmaker. Like, you know, we as critics sit there and absorb so much, and yet we've got to kind of distill onto a page and say, why is this good, why is this not good, and that kind of stuff. But I'm curious if you can talk about what, you know, your journey as a film critic managed to do as a filmmaker. How did it inform you as a filmmaker?
Yes, I started, I mean, I'll say reviewing in quotations, when I was 14 years old. So I sort of kept a little blog, and they're all well and truly off the internet by this point. But they, you know, there's been a record of my opinions on film somewhere from a very young age. But no, I really enjoyed my time as a film critic and a film journalist. And I had a self-run website that I ran. I wrote for some other publications, and I always enjoyed critical analysis of films. And I always enjoy, even now, I mean, I still read reviews, I'll still read articles. I don't know, I enjoy the deep dive into what makes this film work and what didn't work for me personally. And, you know, it's always objective. You know, it's always a personal opinion. You can't ever speak for, like, this is the general consensus on this movie. It's like, no, that's not real film journalism. You know, that's not, you're talking for everyone at that point. And, you know, at times I'd fall into that trap where I'm like, it's the worst movie of the year. It's like, no, I just think it's the worst movie of the year, but I'm not going to tell people that, because then I can't force their opinion on it. So I don't know, I learned a lot about how to approach films analytically. You know, I was self-taught through journalism. I never studied it because obviously I was doing it since I was 14, and just had to sort of evolve my own critical voice. Whether I've been conscious of that voice while making movies, I'm not sure. I'm sure on a subconscious level, it's definitely still in there. You know, like, how I think, like, okay, if I was going to review my own movie, like, what would I say about it? You know, how would I review the script? Are people going to like it? Is it going to land for audiences? So I'm always aware of how I want the audiences to feel and how I guess I want the reviews to be, but maybe not in those exact words.
Well, it's interesting because, like, I've talked to journalists who have become filmmakers, and, you know, in Australia at least, we have a few filmmakers who have come from a journalism background or a film criticism background, but it's not too many of us that have decided, yeah, I can do this. And I always love seeing that journey because, you know, there are a lot of great people who have started in film criticism and then had transitioned over to filmmaking, and I always take my hat off because I know I couldn't do it. Like I, if somebody put a camera in my hands and said, go and make a film, I would fuck it up real quick. So it's always, you know, I'm always in awe of people who make that transition and are able to tell a story really well on screen, at, like you have done with Puzzle Box, which I think is quite a fascinating indie horror film, which leads into the next question, which is how you manage to craft a story within a limited budget. And knowing that you're going into a story, how do you make sure that you've got the best looking stuff on screen to get the best atmosphere, the best like scares or jumps or frights or whatever within a limited budget?
This film had a much smaller budget deliberately than my first film, After She Died. That film, After She Died, was a lot of self-raising funds and bringing in investors and then convincing everyone I know to give me some money, and I owe them favors for the rest of my life now because of it. And I am in development slash trying to get funding in at the moment for a different film that's bigger than both of these movies combined. But I knew that was a ways off at the time. So I thought to myself, okay, I kind of just want to do something that's much smaller, you know, that's more, I can just smash out, you know, I can do for a very limited budget, even less than anything I've ever done, with people that I love working with, people that I've worked with before, people that I know personally, or that my producer, Morgan, he also brought on a bunch of crew that he knows personally. And we got together a real good team of just enthusiastic up-and-coming filmmakers and actors and wonderful people. And so the goal was always to do something for such a limited budget. And that was the appeal of found footage as well, you know, is that you can, I mean, A, I've loved the style and the subgenre of it for years and years and years. I mean, I was at a great age when Paranormal Activity came out. I was quite young, and that was the sort of start of this trend of found footage movies for a number of years. And I was sort of sad when it died off a bit because I loved the format so much. So I always wanted to do something like that, and I wanted to do something that could sort of stretch my creativity into an area that I haven't explored before. And I figured that was a good mix of styles, and I don't know, it just kind of happened, and we just kind of took what we love about this genre and this style and put it all together to try and make the scariest, craziest, wildest, most fun found footage movie that we could.
Outside of this, I know that you've worked in some capacity on films like Shang-Chi, Thor Love and Thunder, and then Furiosa as well, so they're massive Hollywood budget films. What have you taken from working on those that you're able to apply to your own work?
So much. The first day on the set of Shang-Chi, which is my first ever like blockbuster movie. You know, I've done short films and student films, and you know, you go to film school, whatever. You're like, I know how to make a movie. But then you get to the set of something like Shang-Chi, and you know, you walk onto set for the first day, and there's just like hundreds of people everywhere and millions of dollars of equipment. You're like, oh, I have no idea how to make a movie. This is how you make a movie. Okay. And so it was just a really good learning experience just to sort of be there with all of these like Oscar-winning filmmakers and the best crew in the world and all these amazing actors, and just being a part of it and seeing the way that they work and having a small little contribution to how it all comes together is very exciting. But the most exciting part for me was just getting to absorb how that all runs, you know, how a set like that runs, how each department works together, how these famous directors direct these actors. And you know, you find that everyone does direct quite differently. I don't think any of the directors I've worked with have had the same style or approach, which I love. I love seeing how they tackle different types of movies. And I don't know, it's just, I was able to bring so much of that into my experience as a filmmaker. And then I got to the set first day of After She Died, and I was like, okay, I've been on these big sets now. I know how to make a movie. And then I started making After She Died, and I was like, oh, I still don't have any idea how to make a movie. This is still a massive learning curve. And so it really took to the end of that film where I was like, I sort of felt confident as a director. And at that point, the film's over. So you just have to hope that what you shot was good. And I am proud of that movie, but those experiences combined, I felt a lot more confident coming into Puzzle Box and a lot more assured of myself as a filmmaker and my knowledge of how filmmaking works. And even through Puzzle Box, I mean, I once again, I learned so much about, especially working with actors. It was a way more collaborative experience than I've had on other films deliberately, because we wanted it to be this sort of loose back and forth. I didn't want total control of the script or of the characters. I wanted them to explore it. And so it was I don't know, I learned a lot about that through this process as well. And I don't know, I'm excited to bring it all into my next project and the one after that and the one after that and the one after that.
You're talking about like being surrounded by a lot of multi-million dollar things and, you know, Oscar winning filmmakers and stuff like that. That's a huge level of stuff. How do you take that knowledge and then condense it down to micro budget filmmaking? Like there's, and basically where you, all of, you know, each of the roles that might be in a film might then be condensed into one person, which is you. So how did you manage that kind of navigation creatively?
I was very surprised to find that, you know, your $30,000 sets and your $300 million sets are kind of run the same way. Everyone's kind of moving towards the same goal and they're moving towards it in the same approach. It's just a matter of time and money. But structurally, I mean, every set's pretty much, unless you were doing a horrific job of running a set, every set is pretty much the same set. You know, it's got the same dynamics, it's got the same people and the same roles. The bigger budget, the more people, obviously, so you can split those roles off into several departments and several people. When you get to After She Died or even smaller with Puzzle Box, it is like you said, it's different people taking on several jobs at once. Having that experience of seeing 10 people do what one person's doing on this job, you get a strong understanding of like each little component and how it all comes together perfectly and what you should be aware of when you're doing that role on a smaller budget. So you just know more, I guess. That's a cocky way of putting it, I guess.
No, not at all. I don't think it is, because it is, I mean, that's part of the thing. Like it's a huge aspect of why these kinds of films are allowed to be made in Australia. It's the notion that is upskilling people, it is getting that experience of working on a bigger production. So when you do your own film, you can then apply what you've learned there here on a local level.
And I mean, like, I wouldn't necessarily want to do every single job that I've done on these films by myself for every film. You know, at times it does feel like too big a workload. Maybe not so much in Puzzle Box. That was a much smaller film, but definitely on After She Died. I mean, I had probably a few too many hats on that film. But you know, I don't know, you learn how much one person can do before they break. And then you take that knowledge into the next film. You're like, all right, I don't want to do this part of it anymore. I'm going to get somebody else to do that and I can focus on this. And you know, you find the people you like working with and you find what they like to do and what they know and how that knowledge complements your knowledge. And I don't know, you just create a good team from there.
We're almost in like this genre revival this year for Australian films with major films like Talk to Me, of course, and then Godless as well, and then we've got obviously Night of Horror Film Festival as well. What's it like being part of this reemergence of Australian genre films? And by like, I find it interesting when we use the term genre when we really just mean horror or science fiction, but it's like, you know what we mean. But what was it like being part of that kind of movement that's happening right now?
It's super exciting. I mean, I'm fully aware that I'm but a tiny speck in this giant bowl of Australian horror, and I'm just excited to be included in the conversation in any way, shape, or form, because I'm amongst so many amazing films and so many amazing filmmakers. And I mean, Talk to Me, Godless, even Birdie there, which kind of falls a little bit into the genre of horror thriller. I don't know, there's just so many exciting films. And I think Australia's always sort of been at the forefront of these, especially in the last like 20 years, of these very interesting and these very unique horror stories. And our horror stories have resonated quite well overseas and internationally. And that's why there's always this sort of international audience for them, an international thirst for them. And we premiered Puzzle Box in the US already. We haven't premiered here in Australia yet. That'll be at Night of Horror. But people seem to just really like the genre at the moment. I like the genre at the moment. I think it's a really creative time. I think all these filmmakers as well, you look at them, and I mean, most of them aren't going for like government funding. They're not going for big budgets. They're all very independently produced, or they're, you know, they're outside the box, or they're international funding even. And I don't know, all these awesome Australian filmmakers are just getting creative, and in both their filmmaking styles and their approaches to funding and getting films made. And I don't know, it's just exciting. I'm enjoying watching all of these movies, and I'm enjoying seeing what's coming to the big screen soon.
Like, do you want to become known as predominantly a horror filmmaker, or do you want to move into other genres?
I've always loved horror. It's always been a big part of my life, and I definitely am enjoying being in it at the moment and exploring all these horror films at the moment. My next one's also in the realm of horror, but it's not something I necessarily want to do every single film has. You know, there's so many other genres out there that I love and I'd love to explore, and I've got scripts ready to go in other genres. I don't think I'll ever abandon horror. You know, I think it'll always be a part of me.
I want to also talk about the aesthetics of the titles in Puzzle Box. Obviously, it's not a prominent thing in the actual film, but it is. It does actually really lean into the texture of the film as well quite a bit. And I'm curious if you can talk about the creative choice of a certain type of video camera that is used here and a certain type of font that is used for, do you want to delete this memory card? That kind of thing is like such a really, it's a vibe in itself. Can you talk about choosing that?
It's a vibe. I love that. Yeah, no, it was a lot of that came about during the title cards anyway that you're referring to came about during the editing process. They weren't ever in the script. That was without giving away the plot. It's or some spoilers of the plot. It was a way to show the audience that, you know, there's a repetition to the way that things are unfolding in this film. There's a repetition to the cycle of addiction that the character of Kate is going through. And so it was important to visually show that in a way that we hadn't seen before. But I also wanted to incorporate different styles of found footage in the movie, you know. So there is that, you know, they're deleting footage and the card's resetting itself and things are happening over and over again. And then there's also, like, you'll see splices of previous cards that sort of flash throughout the movie. So there's security footage from an incident in Kate's past that you see glimmers of in black and white that sort of come in at the right moments throughout. And so, I don't know, it was a way of sort of showing this endless cycle of addiction and this endless cycle of all the torment and the trauma that she's gone through as a character. And how do we visually explore that in the found footage style? Which, you know, found footage isn't normal. It is not like a traditional narrative. You know, you don't have your traditional camera shots. You don't have your traditional camera, your story structure. You don't typically do flashbacks in found footage, but we wanted to find a way to sort of show glimmers of the past within that style of filmmaking.
Yeah, it gave me echoes of Cloverfield in a way, which is also another really prominent found footage film. But I love the way in your film and also in Cloverfield how those glimpses or the fractures in the memory card kind of inform who the characters are, and it gives us little things to hold on to, which is really nice because that's what we want in a film that is, you know, full of so many twists and turns that we don't know where we're going sometimes. And it's exciting to be able to go down that path of not knowing, but then going, all right, well, let's, you know, what is this 1 second of footage that we just saw? How does that inform who these people are? And of course we get to know, but it is such a really quite a layered way of telling a story. I quite like that aspect of it. So congratulations. It's neat.
Thank you very much.
What are you looking forward to about A Night of Horror the most as well?
Oh, I love it. It's great. We premiered after she died there last year, and we picked up a couple awards there, which was super, super exciting. And unfortunately, last year I was very busy at the time. I was working on a film. So I didn't have a time to see a lot of the films. I only met the filmmakers really at the closing night ceremony. And so this year, I'm really just excited to go and to see the films and to meet the filmmakers and to just sort of see what they've got in store. I don't really know a lot about what each of the films are. So I'm just excited to turn up blind and, you know, go in on the journey and see what happens. No, I mean, it's a great film festival. I mean, Bryn and the team, they do a fantastic job at bringing all of these unique low budget Australian and international horror movies to the big screen and to big sold out audiences. And I don't know, it's a great festival and I love the team there and I love the audience there. And I'm excited to come back. It should be a good year.